Hi, everybody, and welcome to Crime Chamber, my true crime podcast where I share with you the cases that have been keeping me up at night. I'm your host, Lauren, and today we have on the show my fiancé, Riggs, who will be co-hosting with me. And this is episode 5, The Fatal Affair. We're talking about the case of Lacey Peterson. This is a pretty popular case. It's pretty well known.
I don't know it. I've never, other than what you've told me in prior discussions, I've never actually heard of it, but I am not well versed also in murder.
Not well versed. Yeah. I think it's just popular because it's recent. You know? Like,
yeah,
it's one of the only, like, big recent cases that, like, made a huge impact nationwide. But so to start off with some background about Lacey, she grew up with her parents Sharon and Dennis on a farm, actually, in a small town in California. And she helped a lot on the farm, helped her mom with gardening, which actually ended up impacting her later because she ends up, when she goes to college, she goes for horticulture. Her parents divorced when her older brother and her were still pretty young. Her older brother's name is Brent. And so her brother and her move to Modesto, California with her mom. But they still would visit the farm on the weekends sometimes. And both of her parents ended up getting remarried. So her mom, Sharon, marries a man named Ron. And so Lacey gains a stepdad. And then Lacey's father, Dennis, marries a woman named Amy, so then she gains a stepmom as well. Lacey just was known as, like, being this classic, like, all-American, girl-next-door type of person. Like, that's part of the reason why this case got so much attention, was because she just looked like your classic, like, girl-next-door. She was a cheerleader in junior high and high school, and her mom actually named her after a pretty girl that she knew in high school. So just, like, the whole thing, you know? So, like I said, she ends up going to college for ornamental horticulture, and she went to college at Cali Polytech State University, which is between San Francisco and LA, and it's about, I think, like a 3.5 hour drive from Modesto. She has this friend who works at a restaurant in Morro Bay, which is about a 15 or 20 minute drive from her campus, so she would go there a lot to see her friend, and it just so happened that she met her friend's coworker named Scott, and she instantly was, like, attracted to him. And everyone says that Lacey was really outgoing, and she was just the type to make the first move. So she made the first move and gave Scott her number. And even that day, she told her mom that she had met the man she was gonna marry. Eventually, Scott does end up calling Lacey, and they begin going on dates together. Their first date was actually a deep sea fishing trip, and Lacey got seasick on that date.
How do you pick that as your first date?
Well, he was really into boats and fishing, boats and hoes. He was really into fishing and boats, so, like,
oh, okay.
I don't know. And they lived by the water, so I guess it was probably more of a popular thing than it would be in, like, the Midwest.
Yeah.
So actually, Scott had the dream of becoming a professional golfer. That was his dream. But his relationship with Lacey got more serious, so he decides to put this golf dream aside, and he decides that he should probably get a more serious job and possibly something in, like, the business field. So after dating for about 2 years, they moved in together, and they ended up getting married at a resort in August of 1997. They then decided to open a sports bar, and it
together?
Was called, yeah, together. Right. And it was called The Shack. And initially, business was pretty slow.
Yeah, you named it The Shack.
But eventually it started to improve, and especially on weekends, they had a pretty good amount of regulars that would come in. But In 2000, they ended up selling it because they wanted to move back to Modesto to start a family. Modesto is where Lacey's mom lives, so I think they also wanted to be close to her in trying to, like, start a family, too.
Grandmas make cheap babysitters.
So that October, they ended up buying a really nice home. It was actually a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house in a really nice neighborhood that was near La Loma Park. So a really nice house in, like, a suburban kind of area, a really big house. Obviously, they were planning on having kids to kind of fill out the house. And Lacey takes a part-time job as a substitute teacher. And Scott takes a job with, like, a fertilizer company. And he made a lot of money, basically. He made a really good chunk of money. So Lacey only had to have a part-time job. And even then, I don't think she really needed to have the job. I think she just wanted to be doing something. But according to all of her family and friends, she loved being, like, the classic housewife. Like, she loved, like, cooking and cleaning and entertaining, having guests over, just doing all that kind of stuff. So she really liked just being sort of like a stay-at-home wife, I guess, because they didn't have a kid at this point, so not really a stay-at-home mom, but
she was preparing.
Yeah. So they were trying for a baby this whole time, and they were having trouble getting pregnant. And actually, she was just about to have them, like, do in vitro fertilization. And then in 2002, she actually announces her pregnancy. And so at this point, she is 27 years old, and the baby is due about mid-February of 2003. So they end up finding out that they are having a boy, and so they pick out the name Connor for him.
That's a nice name.
Yeah. So the weird part is, though, it was spelled, like, with an E-R, not an O-R.
Oh, that is
kind of weird, yeah.
It's not terrible or anything, but it's just, yeah, anyways, different. Trying to switch it up in 2003.
So this is kind of where the story begins, like a play-by-play of the days. So this is late 2002, the day before Christmas Eve, and Lacey and Scott decide to go to Lacey's stepmom's salon, so Amy's salon. And they would go there all the time, about, like, every month to get Scott's haircut. So they go there and get Scott's haircut right before Christmas, and they're talking to Amy, and, you know, it's all friendly conversation, everything is great, going good, and Scott even offers to pick up this fruit basket that Amy had bought for, her father. And so he said this because they were talking about their plans for the next day, for Christmas Eve, and Scott says that he's gonna be going golfing. She mentions that she got her dad this fruit basket, and it would be at some, like, little marketplace, and it was actually nearby the golf course that he said he was going to be golfing at. So he said to her, you know, I'm actually going to be over in that area, I can just pick it up for you. So that was a pretty nice thing, I think, to do. So around 8:30 that night, after Scott got his haircut and they got home, Lacey and her mom talked on the phone, just about, like, Christmas plans, Christmas Eve, their dinner, all that kind of stuff. The next thing that we really hear is that the next day on Christmas Eve, around 5:45 p.m., Ron Gransky, which is Lacey's stepfather, calls 911 and reports Lacey Peterson as missing. So, I listened to the 911 call because it is public, and something that stood out to me is that he says that his son-in-law just called him and told him that while he was out golfing, his wife went on a walk with their dog and never came back. So Scott says he was golfing, okay? So at this point, she's 8.5 months pregnant, and they figure that she was probably on a walk with her dog, and maybe she fell and got hurt, and she's, you know, maybe she's not able to get up, or she's injured somewhere, and that, like, she's in need of help.
Yeah, because that's pretty pregnant. I mean, she was due.
You said that's pretty pregnant.
It is pretty pregnant.
Oh, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
That's like, yeah, she was very pregnant. Like,
yeah, like, she was very close to having a child.
Yeah, like, I mean, if it came early, she's having that baby in a couple weeks max. So, uh-huh.
Yeah,
it's grounds for worry.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And she had even said to her mom and her, like, stepdad that she had been really, really tired lately as she, like, got further into the pregnancy, and that she hadn't been taking the dog for as many walks just because she didn't feel like she had the energy to do so. So I think that just kind of was also in the back of their mind when she didn't come back from this walk. So the police come to the home, the Peterson home, and the police say that Scott was acting completely calm throughout this whole initial meeting, which I'm not really one to, like, say whether or not that makes someone guilty or innocent, because it doesn't. Like, everyone reacts differently. But it just seems like he would be a little concerned.
Well, especially, we're not talking, like, days after the crime. We're not talking about, even if we know there's a crime, we're just straight up talking, hey, your wife is missing, who's right. very pregnant.
Yeah.
You think you would be worried a little bit more.
Right. They ended up carrying out a huge search the next day for Lacey, which included helicopters and police on horseback and bicycles and canine units, water rescue units, rafts, volunteers, family, friends, everyone posting flyers,
so yeah, the
raising
whole nine
awareness.
Yards.
Yeah, it was insane. Everyone in Modesto came together to try to find Lacey. So at the press conference that was held that night, there was two main detectives on the case, and one of the detectives' name was Detective Bercini. And he said that night at the press conference that police didn't believe that Lacey had voluntarily left without informing her family.
So this was on Christmas Day they had this press conference?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, this is on Christmas Day. He adds, you know, this is completely out of her character. She wouldn't do something like this. And kind of hints at the fact that, hey, this is a serious thing. Either she's out injured somewhere or there's some sort of foul play.
Yeah.
So this makes nationwide news almost
immediately.
Understandable. Right. Because it's this pregnant woman. It's Christmas time. So everyone's kind of just like, you know, a pregnant woman who's like this all-American gal goes missing on Christmas Eve. People are going to be worried. So it makes national news like right away. And immediately, a $25,000 reward is offered for information leading to Lacey's safe return.
Which things like that can be good or bad. I feel like you get a lot of people just calling in trying to get money mm-hmm. sometimes when you put out
yep.
things like that. I understand the worry and thinking that might bring information quicker, though.
Yeah. And actually, that reward quickly increased to $250,000.
Oh, jeez.
And then...
Who's putting up all this money?
I don't know, but then it raised to $500,000. So they were really trying.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. So they had this out, but really no one came forward with anything, especially not anything that
substantial.
Right. So they were distributing posters, flyers, ribbons. And there was even a website created called LaceyPeterson.com that was launched just to raise more awareness and have information and photos of Lacey for people to look at. And her friends and family and just some other people of the community set up kind of like a headquarters, like a hotline center, for the search. And it was actually at a nearby hotel, and they kind of just were there to like answer phone calls and record developments in the case, make and print flyers that they would distribute, stuff like that. And Scott really wanted nothing to do with it.
Which seems strange.
Right. He didn't want to be in any of the photos that were of Lacey on the posters, or any photos of Lacey that were posted anywhere being like, this is the woman that's missing. He didn't want to be in any of those. So the moment that there was a picture of him and Lacey anywhere, he would be like, take that down.
Which is weird too. It's not like they're both of the same sex and you're like,
yeah,
you could
don't
get
want them to confuse or something.
Confused who you're looking for or anything. Yeah.
Right. So he, not only did he not want to really have anything to do with this like hotline center type deal, he also didn't want to talk to the media at all. So this is just not typical in a missing persons case. Because
no, it's very strange.
Most of the time, family and friends, close family and friends, really want to talk to the media as much as they can, because when someone's missing and you don't know, they could be still alive. You want as many people to hear about it as possible. You want this to reach as many people. So most of the time, parents, siblings, spouses, friends of a missing person will try to get on any platform that they can to spread the word. But Scott just didn't want to do any of this. So Lacey's parents were, however, taken to the media, thankfully. But it's just weird that Scott didn't want anything to do with it and didn't want to use those opportunities to get the word out there about Lacey.
Yeah, I mean, not to say it looks suspicious, but I mean, something seems up if you're not trying to, you know,
mm-hmm.
help at all with, you know, your very pregnant wife's missing person case.
Yeah, definitely just a little bit odd. But, you know, like I said earlier, everyone kind of reacts to these things differently. So I don't think that that automatically is like, oh, he's guilty, you know.
No, I agree.
I think it's
just
something
very strange
to note, for sure.
Yeah.
Right. So another thing that a lot of the people mentioned who were at this hotline center was that before they could even let the media in, Scott wouldn't let them, like, Scott wouldn't allow them to let the media in until he had exited out of the back door. So he, like, didn't even want to be, like, seen there. I don't know, really weird. Over 1,500 volunteers came together for Lacey's search and to help with, like, distributing information. So a lot of people were involved.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. That's a lot of people.
And, like, not one of those was Scott. As the police helped in these searches to find Lacey, they were also kind of thinking, you know, at this point, they're like, this is probably some sort of foul play, right? Because at this point, they had searched the park where she had supposedly been walking, and, like, if she had just been injured somewhere, they probably would have found her by now. So the police are thinking, like, okay, who could possibly be responsible for Lacey's disappearance, or maybe just even have some information about Lacey's disappearance. So, as in pretty much all missing persons cases, the first people that are contacted are the closest people to that missing person. So, instantly, the spouses become a person of interest, the parents, the siblings, friends, things like that. And most specifically, the people who have seen them the most recently. So for Lacey, this was Scott and her stepmom, Amy, when they were getting their haircut. So the police go to Amy and they ask her about the interactions that she had with Scott and Lacey the night before. But Amy said that they were acting completely normal. Nothing was out of the ordinary and everything was like usual. When they went to talk to Scott, however, he just seemed to be acting a little bit strange. So one thing that the police noted right away was that Scott was talking about Lacey in the past tense, kind of like as if she was no longer alive. So he said something like, quote, Lacey was amazing, end quote. Like, he said things like that that made it sound like, oh, she was amazing, not Lacey is amazing.
Yeah, but to play the other side, she's been missing for a little bit here.
Yeah.
I mean, you... Even if you have nothing, not involved at all, you could be just already assuming the worst. I mean, it's not like she just wandered off or dipped, you know? She was very pregnant, so.
Yeah.
Not saying that is a good sign. You should not be. Him talking in the past tense is kind of suspicious, but.
I think it's just weird.
It's very strange. A lot of things Scott has been doing seem very strange.
Strange, yeah. So, like I said before, there's two lead detectives on the case. One of them is Alan Burchini, and the other one is John Bueller. And those two are the ones that questioned Scott that evening. Detective Bueller actually ends up telling ABC News in 2017, quote, I suspected Scott when I first met him. Didn't mean he did it, but I was a little bit thrown off by his calm, cool demeanor and his lack of questioning. He wasn't, will you call me back? Can I have one of your cards? What are you guys doing now? End quote. So, I guess instantly for him, it was that Scott seemed like he was acting weird.
Yeah, because he didn't feel enough concern from him.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, like, in these situations, when there's a missing person case and the police are trying to do whatever they can, the spouse or the parents would usually be like, well, what are you doing? Where are you looking next? What are you doing? Can I have your card? When are you going to call me?
Yeah, usually they're overly interested in what the detective is doing.
Exactly. And I think that just kind of was out of the normal, you know, routine for the detectives.
Yeah, it seemed like it maybe rubbed him the wrong... It seemed like it rubbed the detective the wrong way.
Definitely. So that's just something interesting as well. When asked about the events that kind of led up to Lacey's disappearance, this is what Scott reported. So the following that I'm going to explain is everything from Scott's story, what Scott told the police. So on the morning of the 24th, Christmas Eve, Lacey woke up around 7 a.m. and Scott stayed in bed for a little bit longer. Lacey ate breakfast right away because apparently she did that every day when she was pregnant because she did it to avoid being sick and getting morning sickness. So by the time Scott woke up around 8 or 8:30, Lacey had already eaten breakfast, but she still sat down with him while he was eating and had a piece of toast or something like that. And he said that he was eating cereal. He gave a lot of detail on this part. So he even specified that he had specifically been eating cinnamon puffins from Trader Joe's. And interestingly enough, the police ended up finding a receipt from Trader Joe's showing that that cereal had been purchased by Lacey the day before at Trader Joe's. So he was telling the truth about that. So then around 8:40, Scott says that he got into the shower, and while he was in the shower, Lacey got onto their computer, which was located in their spare room. And you know, obviously Scott doesn't know what Lacey was looking at when he was in the shower, but when the police looked back at the computer records, it showed that there was the MSN homepage open, a weather site from Yahoo, and two Yahoo shopping websites. And the two shopping pages were for a red scarf from Gap, and the other one was for a sunflower umbrella. And Lacey was known for, like, loving sunflowers. She even had a sunflower tattoo. So to police, this kind of proved that Lacey was still alive and in her home at 8:45 on Christmas Eve morning. But some people also think that it could have been Scott just kind of like staging it.
Yeah, searching things that they know would fit his story. But I mean, assumably, it was probably her.
Right, it was probably her. That's what I think, at least. So as Scott got out of the shower and got dressed, Scott said that Lacey started telling him what she was going to be doing that day, which was that she was going to walk the dog, go to the store, and make gingerbread. And he remembers that Lacey specifically said she needed to go to the store because she needed to buy bread that she needed in order to make some French toast that they were going to have at their Christmas brunch the next day. And the police end up finding the recipe for this French toast on the counter in the Peterson's kitchen. So that's also just like a detail that he was being honest about. So Scott says after that, he then loaded some of their patio umbrellas from the backyard into the bed of his truck because he was gonna go, store them at his warehouse. So apparently while he was doing this, a neighbor saw him outside and they said hi to each other, and the neighbor asked, you know, what they were doing today. And Scott just mentioned that he was going golfing to the neighbor. So after coming back inside, he filled up the mop bucket for Lacey because she wanted to mop the floor. And Scott then says that he and Lacey were watching the Today Show, and then after that they turned on Martha Stewart. And Scott even specifically recalled that that day's Martha Stewart show was about meringue and cookies. And when the police actually investigated this, they found that Martha Stewart was playing on TV on December 4th, specifically around 9:45 that morning, and that they had mentioned meringue and cookies on that episode.
You mean December 24th?
Yeah. What did I say?
The 4th.
Oh, December 24th. Yes, December 24th. So Scott drives to the warehouse to drop off the patio umbrellas that he loaded up into his truck, and at 10:08 a.m. he checks his voicemail, finding that he had a message from his boss. And Scott told the police that he checked his email at his office and then sent an email to his boss in regard to the voicemail that he had heard. Computer forensics later showed that Scott had been logged onto his work computer for about 26 minutes, between 10:30 and 10:56 a.m. The search of his computer history found that he had checked his email, sent an email, and then looked up instructions on how to kill someone. Just kidding. Instructions on how to assemble a specific woodworking tool called a mortiser. Do you know what that is?
No.
Me either. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I don't know what it is. But a specific woodworking tool, okay? So he had actually just received this tool via UPS a few days before this. So there's about a 20-minute gap between when Scott logged off of his computer and when he left the warehouse. And Scott says that during this time, he was cleaning up the office a bit and he had began to assemble his new tool that he had looked up the instructions for. And he actually made a point of telling the police that they might find his blood on the driver's side door of his truck because he had cut his finger on his toolbox while trying to assemble his woodworking tool. And he says that he opened his truck door to reach in and grab a napkin to stop the bleeding. So later on, Forensic testing showed a drop of Scott's blood on the car door, as he had stated, and the tool was found in his warehouse assembled. So, as we recall, Scott said that he was planning on going golfing that day. But he felt that it was too cold, apparently, so he decided to head to the Berkeley Marina and go fishing instead. So this is what he tells the police. He says, you know, I decided to go fishing instead. His boat's in this warehouse, so he hooks it up to the truck, leaves the warehouse, and at 11:18 a.m., he starts to drive to the marina. Scott says that he thinks it probably took him about an hour and a half to get there, and says that then he launched his boat at the marina. And when Scott told the police this, they asked him, like, hey, do you have any proof that you were actually there? And he was like, oh yeah, I actually do. And he handed over his boat launch ticket from earlier that day, which had been purchased at 12:54 at the Berkeley Marina. So he had proof that he was really there at that time. One of the detectives on the case also interviewed a maintenance worker that was present at the marina during the time that Scott should have been there, and the worker confirmed seeing Scott's vehicle, and he even remembered that Scott had some trouble backing the trailer in to get the boat out of the water, which is kind of funny. So Scott tells the police that he was probably at the bay for about an hour and a half. From the time that Scott bought the ticket to when his cell phone records show him leaving the area is about 78 minutes, and he says he was there for about 90 minutes, so that's pretty accurate. So he says that he then leaves the marina, he calls Lacey at home and on her cell phone and she doesn't answer, and he leaves her voicemail on her cell phone when she doesn't answer. So now I'm going to play this clip of a voicemail.
Hey, beautiful. I won't be able to get to the Villa Farms to get that basket for Papa. I was hoping you would get this message and go on out there. I'll see you in a bit, sweetie. Love you. Bye.
So he mentions the fruit basket that he,
Said he was gonna pick up,
yeah. He says that he then pulled over for gas at a gas station and tried to call Lacey again. Again, she didn't answer. And his bank records do confirm that he made a purchase at this gas station at 3:25 p.m. His phone records also show that he made another call to Lacey's cell phone at 3:52, but he doesn't leave a message this time. He then returns back to his warehouse around 4:15 and puts his boat back into storage. So Scott estimates that he arrived home between 4:30 and 4:45 p.m. So he enters through the side gate into their backyard and finds their dog Mackenzie with his leash still on. So Scott says
in the backyard?
In their backyard, yeah. And they had like a fenced in backyard so that their dog could be back there. But the weird thing is that the dog still had its leash on. So Scott says that he removed the leash and brought the dog in, and it was actually discovered later that night that their neighbor had actually found Mackenzie wandering alone, like on the road with his leash on around 10:30 that morning. So the neighbor returned the dog to the Petersons' fenced-in backyard because they, you know, they recognized the dog.
Mm-hmm.
So Scott says that he then entered his home and brought Mackenzie along with their cats inside with them. Scott says that the mop bucket was still filled with water and in the kitchen, and he said that it seemed like one of the cats might drink out of it, so he decided he was going to go dump it out. So he goes out near the front walkway of the house and places the mop in the mop bucket there. He also went out to the mailbox while he was outside and got the mail, and Lacey's car was in the driveway, but she wasn't home. So Scott says that he assumed Lacey had probably went to her mom Sharon's house to help her prepare for their Christmas Eve dinner, and he assumed that Sharon had probably just picked Lacey up. So therefore, Scott says he wasn't initially worried about Lacey. He just figured that she was at her mom's house. So apparently at this point, he decides to take his clothes off and put them into the washing machine because he says that they were wet from fishing. And he tells the police that it wasn't out of the ordinary for him to remove his clothes and wash them immediately when he got home because he typically and often worked with chemicals. So he said that this was something like normal for him to do.
But he wasn't working with chemicals, he was just fishing.
Yeah, yeah. And his clothes were wet, so he decided to wash them. Doesn't really make sense.
No, it seems odd.
So he then took some leftover pizza out of the fridge, poured himself a glass of milk, you know, he's just chilling. And he heads to the shower with a piece of pizza in his hand. He's just hardcore chilling. Hardcore chilling.
That hardcore chill.
No, but for real. So
Thank you for arresting my son.
What? So Officers testify later that the pizza box was on the counter when they arrived at the Peterson home that evening. So that's also probably true, but, like, that's not necessarily a good thing that that's true. Like, it's not necessarily a good thing that he decided to grab some pizza and take a shower, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
it seems odd.
It's kind of like, fuck, like, your wife is missing, bro. So, he then gets out
of
the shower.
At this point, though, did he know his, in his mind?
In his mind, I guess, Lacey wasn't missing. Okay. In his mind, I mean, according to him,
yeah,
in his mind
he
at
never...
this time... Lacey was at her parents' house, but he never confirmed.
I was gonna
this.
Say he never called her mom and stepdad.
Right. Like, if I got home, you're not a pregnant woman, and if I got home and you weren't here and I had no idea where you were and you hadn't been answering your phone for the past 2 hours, I would be fucking concerned. You know.
Well, especially with the dog. The dog makes it
yeah.
super weird.
Yeah. Like, and you knew that she was gonna take the dog for a walk. Like, if I got home and our dog was just like had his leash on and was in the backyard and you were nowhere to be found. I would be so sketched out. Like, I would immediately think something bad happened, but also I just kind of think of that stuff.
No, yeah, but it's understandable.
Yeah. But anyways, he says he wasn't concerned, and he decides to take a shower. He gets out of the shower, gets dressed, and he goes back in the kitchen and listens to some messages that were left on their answering machine. So he hears the message that he had left for Lacey when he was leaving the marina, and then he hears a message from Ron, Lacey's stepdad, asking if Lacey would bring over some whipped cream when they come over for dinner. So Scott says that this is kind of the point where he gets confused because he assumed that Lacey was already at Ron and Sharon's house. So he's like, why would they be calling and asking her to bring some whipped cream over if she's already over there? So at this point, he's like, I should probably call them. So at 5:17, he decides to call Ron and Sharon's home. And like I said earlier, he pretty much just asked if Lacey's there. They say no, and to this, Scott responds, Lacey is missing. At this point, the search for Lacey begins. So, that's Scott's story of what happened that day. So, what do you think about that? Do you think that that's an accurate representation of what went on?
Well, I mean, for the most part, it has to be because he has records. There's things placing him at almost every single place. The thing I find the strangest is that he never, like, if I was all of a sudden going to change my plans from going golfing to going fishing, especially in an age with, I mean, they had cell phones and things, but a little less technology to see where people are and stuff, I would definitely have called and mentioned that, you know,
yeah.
that seems like a pretty big switch of plans and change of where you're going. You think... on your way to that event, you would be mentioning, hey, I'm going to go fishing now. So that's the part that kind of stands out strange to me. That and the lack of worry from him. I mean, he comes across, in his version of the story, he comes across as kind of an idiot. He does, in the sense
know,
that, like,
funny.
Oh, I just found my dog in the backyard with his leash. I found the mop water not poured out. She probably just left everything like this is just... it's just very strange. And I get right. In California, the weather's nicer, so leaving your dog outside is a less of a
but
faux pas.
Though.
But the leash is so strange. And it just you would think you would start putting everything together more so, especially because then he doesn't even call and check immediately after, hey, this is where she is.
Yeah.
You know? And the washing clothes thing's really weird. There's just a lot of really weird things inside of his story,
mm-hmm.
even though... say most of it matches up.
Yeah. Because do you think that if this situation happened with, like, me and you, like, if I was Lacey, you know, in the situation, like, if you came home and I wasn't, like, do you think that those are things that you would do? Or do you think it would have played out completely differently?
I mean, it would have played out differently. I definitely would have called your mother immediately. I definitely would have questioned about the dog. I definitely... don't wash my clothes in a single wash, especially if I was just fishing. Mm-hmm. If they're wet, you can hang them up on it. I mean, it's California. Maybe it wasn't that nice that day, but you could hang them up on a line or on your fence, and they'll dry out pretty quick. It just seems – there's a lot of things like that just seem very strange.
When Scott called Sharon to ask about Lacey, he did mention that their dog was in the backyard with his leash on, and so Sharon's first thought was that Lacey must have been – walking the dog and that they should look for her in the park nearby. So Scott, Sharon, Amy, and Ron and a couple other friends and family members met up at La Loma Park to look for Lacey there.
Is this before or after they called the police?
This is after.
Okay.
I think this is just right after. Yeah, because while they're at the park, a police officer calls Scott, and he asks for permission to enter and search the Peterson home. And Scott says that he won't agree to anything without the approval of his lawyer.
Which, like, what is that?
Yeah.
I mean, you could have, on the other side of that, you could have maybe other sketchy things. Like, you could maybe, there's a few things you could own that would make you not want to have a policeman just walk. Like, if he illegally owned a gun or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just because, like, if you would happen to own anything illegally, whether that be drugs, whether that be weapons.
But if I was missing and the cops were like, can we come search your home? Would you be worried about?
No. I would say just go in, and if they find it, they find it. But I can't speak for someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I'm just kind of playing the other side, because, I mean, he paints himself already as such a, his moves paint himself as, I guess, the bad guy in the story either way. And so it's just, but there are logical reasons why he would say no, not saying that it makes it okay.
I agree. I think he,
very sketchy though.
If he was innocent, you know, if he is innocent, he could have been worried in this moment too, you know, like he could know, like, oh, a lot of times they look at the husband first, and he could have been worried that they would try to just pin it on him right away and look for anything possible in the house to try to, like, use it against him, even if it was nothing. So maybe that could be possible too. Like, but it's kind of unclear.
Yeah, you know? It's still very strange.
So the thing is, his lawyer doesn't get back to him soon enough, and so the police just decide to search the home anyway.
Isn't that illegal?
Yeah, I believe so. So in order to ensure the integrity of any evidence, Scott wasn't allowed to come back into the house unless he was accompanied by a police officer for the rest of that night. So the police enter the home. They find Lacey's keys, her wallet, and her sunglasses inside of her purse, which was in a closet. So obviously, since it was Christmas Eve, the dining room table was all set perfectly. It was ready for their Christmas dinner or brunch, whatever they were having, that was supposed to be taking place the next day. So the only somewhat suspicious thing they found during this initial look at the home was that there was a phone book sitting open on the kitchen counter, and the page that was left open was a full page ad for a defense lawyer. But, like, it kind of makes sense, because he did say, you know, like, I have to talk to my lawyer first. It just seems weird that your first thought when your wife's missing is, oh, let me just quick get a lawyer, though.
But also, wasn't it, and it could be what you were describing as, he initially just knows a lot of times the husband gets blamed. But at this point, all they know is that she's missing. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I thought they called him while he was at the park. So that means he was looking for a lawyer prior.
Right, yeah. Yeah, like he already was on the search for a lawyer before that. They also found the mop and the bucket, which didn't smell like disinfectant or bleach or anything. But they decided to take these into evidence anyway. And let's remember what Scott said, which was that they were outside because Lacey was supposed to be mopping. It was full when he got back, blah, blah, blah. So that's what he says happened. They also found some dirty wet rags on top of the washing machine, and they took those into evidence as well. But Scott explained that he had taken those out of the washing machine earlier when he had put his dirty clothes inside. And he said that the rags were dirty because the day before their house cleaner was there and she had used them. And the police actually confirmed this and got in contact with the house cleaner herself. And she confirmed that she did use those rags and that they were in the laundry machine prior to him taking them out. So the rags didn't seem like anything really suspicious either. And the police also searched the home for any signs of blood. They used a specific light source to do this, but no blood was found at all. And one of the searching officers, Derek Letzinger, even made the statement that there were no signs at all of foul play in the house. The officers say he was generally cooperative, and that he was really calm. He lets them know, however, before they search his truck, that he has a gun in his glove box from a recent hunting trip that he had gone on. And the detectives did locate the gun inside of the vehicle, and they brought that in for testing as well. But the test showed that the gun had not been fired recently. They also searched his warehouse and his boat. And the only really notable thing that they found in the warehouse and the boat was that there was a pair of needle-nose pliers that had a single strand of hair in the clamping part of the pliers, which was dark and about 5 or 6 inches long. And they tested this piece of hair against hair from Lacey's brush, and it was a match. So there was essentially a piece of Lacey's hair inside of pliers in his warehouse.
Which is kind of weird.
Yeah, that's definitely a little weird. But the pliers were really rusted, and so one of the forensic experts said that he didn't necessarily believe that they had even been used recently. And that wasn't a for sure statement. Like, he isn't completely ruling out that they were used recently, but I think he more so was kind of just saying, like, we shouldn't be looking too much into this because the way that they're rusted so badly kind of makes him think that they hadn't been used recently. So the media was in a complete frenzy about the case, and within 24 hours of Lacey going missing, everyone had heard the news that Scott had been at the Berkeley Marina the day that Lacey disappeared, and that caused a lot of suspicion for Scott. So by early January, Scott was under 24-hour surveillance. There was also a GPS tracking system placed on his truck by the third week in January. At this point in the search, though, Lacey's friends and family still fully supported Scott. Lacey's mom, Sharon, said that she thought the world of Scott. She had never seen him get violent with Lacey or even raise his voice. Everyone said that they were a perfect couple, that when they met, they were instantly head over heels for each other. And it just seemed like they had a really perfect relationship. And even to Lacey's friends and family, they all said that they never heard of any problems between Scott and Lacey at all. Everyone seemed to think that they had a completely perfect relationship, and all of Lacey's close friends agreed with Sharon that they couldn't see Scott ever doing anything violent towards Lacey. However, on December 30th of 2002, the Modesto police received a call from a woman named Amber Fry, who reported that she was having an affair with Scott Peterson.
What?
So, Amber Fry's affair with Scott Peterson began sometime in November of 2002. Amber shows the police pictures of her and Scott together, specifically one picture of them together at a Christmas party. And Amber was a 27-year-old massage therapist, a single mother, and she was living in Fresno, California, which was a nearby town. So their story begins in that October, however, when Scott attends this work trade convention and he meets this other woman named Sean Sibley. And Scott tells Sean that he's, quote, single and looking, and jokes to her that he should have written, quote, horny bastard, end quote, on his name tag to help him meet women.
And he's married with a pregnant wife by this point, right?
Yes, this is in October.
Yeah, oh, geez, yeah, very. So yeah. They weren't dating for very long when they started dating.
No, nope. So Sean herself was kind of interested in Scott, but she couldn't shake the thought that he felt perfect for her friend Amber. So Sean gives Scott Amber's phone number, and 26 days later, on November 19th, Scott finally gives Amber a call. They plan to meet up the next day at a bar in Fresno, and they follow that with dinner at a nearby restaurant, and then spend the night together at a hotel in Fresno. Within that first night of them meeting, Scott tells Amber various lies about his life already. So he tells her that he was going to be fishing in Alaska for Thanksgiving with his father, his brother, and his uncle, which wasn't true. He was going to be with Lacey on Thanksgiving. He said that he would be in Maine with his parents for Christmas, which also was not true. He would be with Lacey on Christmas. And he tells her that he would be in Paris for New Year's and in Europe for the month of January on business. Of course, none of these statements were true.
Did she actually believe he was going to be in Paris for fertilizer business?
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that before. It doesn't exactly seem like the kind of job where you'd be traveling internationally, but, you know, who knows. Anyways, it seems like he was just kind of purposely making himself busy on these holidays so that Amber wouldn't try to make plans with him on those days since he already had plans with Lacey. And Scott and Amber stayed connected over the phone and through text when they couldn't be together in person. But when they could be together in person, Scott would sometimes spend the night at Amber's house. So on December 6th, Sean Sibley, the girl from the work confession who introduced the two, was having lunch with some of her colleagues, and there was some gossip at the table. And Sean heard someone say that Scott was married. Sean is immediately shocked and calls Scott and asks him if this is true, and Scott tells her, no, I'm not married. So, not only does he say, no, I am not married, he also says, no, I was never married, have never been married. So something that Amber asked him at the beginning of their relationship was, have you ever been married? Do you have any kids? To both of those things, he said no.
Yeah, which is a crazy lie to say. It's not even like he was trying to play that he was, like, divorced or anything.
But about an hour later, he calls her back, and he's like, actually, no, I was married, but my wife died.
What?
And this is still...
Died?
This is still... December 6th. Sean says, you know, you have till Monday to tell Amber this, otherwise I'm gonna tell her myself. So, and this was on a Friday. So Scott waits until Monday, until the last possible minute, and decides to tell Amber the truth, which was actually just another lie. So this is only 2 weeks before Lacey goes missing at this point. He tells Amber that he was actually a widower, and that his wife had died, and that it would be his first Christmas without her.
Which ends up being true.
Yeah, but, like, how did he know that was going to be true?
I know.
So,
I'm just saying.
Right, it's just so fucked. A few days later, Scott and Amber go to a birthday party together. And then a few days after that, on December 14th, they went to a Christmas party together. And Scott stays overnight at Amber's house. And it would end up that this would actually be the last time Scott would see Amber in person before seeing her while she's testifying at his trial in 2004.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm. So the day after Lacey's disappearance on Christmas Day, Amber tries to call Scott twice, and eventually Scott calls her back. In the midst of all this insanity going on, he somehow finds the time to call his mistress back in the craziest part of the search for his wife. In the first 6 days of Lacey missing, it's reported that Scott made 11 calls to Amber.
Jeez, that's a lot.
Yeah, and apparently Amber made even more calls to Scott. So... they talked on the phone probably more than 11 times. It's just that 11 of those times, Scott was the one making contact, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Their month-long romance kind of comes crashing down when, on December 30th, Amber finds out in the early morning from a friend in law enforcement that Scott was married to the missing woman from Modesto. So, of course, Amber had heard of this missing woman from Modesto because, like I said, it was so, so widely in the media. But she hadn't put together that Scott was married to her, obviously.
Well, yeah, especially with him, obviously, for the reason being he was pulling all his pictures was to avoid this from happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. When she discovers this, she just starts sobbing. And eventually she pulls herself together enough to call the Modesto police, and she reports their affair. So a little bit later that morning, they meet up with Amber at a Radio Shack. Hashtag throwback Radio Shack.
Rest in peace.
Anyways, they met up at Radio Shack and they purchased a bunch of equipment that they were going to use to record Amber's calls with Scott. So Amber agrees to work with the police, and she agrees that her phone calls with Scott can be recorded.
Which, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Because she thinks this dude is just scum now.
Yeah, she's freaked. So she actually says later in an interview that right when they got it all hooked up, all the equipment hooked up, and right when they, like, figured out how it all worked and everything, Scott actually called her right, like, that second. And she said it was just, like, surreal that that happened. And the police were just looking at her like, holy shit, I can't believe he's calling you right now, kind of thing. So the police kind of asked Amber, you know, just keep in contact with Scott, try to see if he'll say anything, maybe even confess to having anything to do with Lacey's disappearance. And for almost 2 months, they recorded her phone calls with Scott.
During any of this time, though, does she ask about her? Like, does she...
No.
So she
remains acting like she has no idea.
And she's hoping that he's just going to incriminate himself.
Right. So...
which seems like a big ask, if you're asking me, just because
yeah.
She technically was never like, it was Scott's intention for her to never even know he had a wife.
Yeah, it seems like this would be the absolute last time that he'd bring it up. Like, oh, by the way, yeah, I do have a wife, and also she's missing, and also they think that I'm a suspect in her murder.
Yeah, unless he was completely breaking down and thought he could confide in her, but it's not like they were together that long where, you know.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure.
I just think the police were looking for any and every lead they could.
Yeah, and actually it ends up being something. So one of the calls that kind of really stands out was on New Year's Eve, during the same time that Lacey's family and friends were meeting for a candlelight vigil in honor of Lacey. And instead of paying attention at the vigil and honoring his missing and pregnant wife, Scott was on the phone with his mistress, Amber, while at the vigil. So it's not that he was just not at the vigil at all. He was there, but a lot of people didn't even know he was there because he was laying so low and not really speaking with anyone, and not really being, like, the family members were up on the stage talking, thanking people for being there, you know, saying things about Lacey, and he never once went up on the stage, he never made any statements, and apparently at some point he was on the phone with Amber at this vigil.
Which is very disrespectful.
Extremely.
But can I also say a quick note here, even if he had nothing to do with her disappearing, maybe he was so, and this is just me, you know, kind of playing my own little detective, I guess. But even if he had nothing to do with her disappearing, obviously the reason he was so calm was he probably felt like it was like an act of God or something, that he's just like, he's going to get away with. Obviously he was not happy with her in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he wanted out of the relationship if he was seeing a mistress, you know, if he was seeing another woman. So even if he had nothing to do with it, he was probably, the reason he was so calm is because
he was relieved.
Yeah, he was happy he didn't have to keep living this double life. Mm-hmm. But it's all really fucked up.
Yeah. Scott tells Amber during this phone call that he was in Paris on a business trip, as we remember from earlier, and that he was celebrating New Year's Eve there. And their conversation was actually pretty short on this phone call. Scott mostly just talked about how he was near the Eiffel Tower. The crowd was huge. The celebration was amazing. But their call kept breaking up, and he couldn't hear her, and she couldn't hear him. So eventually Scott just ends the call and says, "Hey, I'll call you tomorrow." So on January 6, 2003, Scott calls Amber and admits that he's been telling her some lies. So here's a recording of their phone call, or part of the phone call from that day.
The worst thing in the world.
Okay.
And I'm so sorry that this has happened, and I'm so sorry I'm going to hurt you in this way. I don't want to do this over the phone. I want to tell you this. I want to be there in person and tell you this. But I'm sure that's why Saki called you.
What?
I'm sure it's why Saki called me.
Why would Saki? What are you talking about?
It's the worst thing. Sorry, Emma. I'll just tell you.
Okay.
You haven't been watching the news, obviously.
No.
I have not been traveling during the last couple of weeks. I've lied to you when I've been traveling.
Okay.
The girl I'm married to, her name is Lacey.
Mm-hmm.
She disappeared just before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
For the past 2 weeks, I've been in Modesto with her family and mine, searching for her.
Okay.
She just disappeared, and no one knows.
Okay, now
where she's been.
Scott.
And I can't tell you more, because I need you to be protected from the media and Ayanna.
Okay,
they are amazing.
Scott, are you listening?
I am.
You came to me earlier in December and told me that you had lost your wife. What was that about?
She's alive.
What?
She's alive.
Where? She's alive? Where?
In Modesto. Now, I know this is the hardest. I wanted to tell you first. You need to protect yourself from the media.
Okay.
Okay, if you've been watching the news at all, or you haven't, the media has been telling everyone that I had something to do with her disappearance.
What did he mean by, I mean, he could have just meant that she was alive at that point.
Yeah, so I think what he meant, what he was saying there was that she's like, what was that about when you told me that you lost your wife? And I think he was just saying like, no, like, she was alive. Like, that wasn't true. You know, she was alive. I don't think he meant to say like, she's alive right now.
Yeah, but it comes across as she's alive right now.
So then Amber immediately is like freaking out. She's like, she's alive? Where? But like, that's not what Scott meant.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that's what he meant.
He was like, in Modesto. Like, he doesn't understand what she's actually trying to ask there. But yeah, so that's their little conversation where he finally kind of gives her some sort of information on what's been going on. And then on January 24th of 2003, Amber reveals to the public how she was romantically involved with Scott. And this happens during a press conference. However, before Amber and the police decided to go public about the affair, the police decided that it would be best to sit down with Lacey's parents and let them know about the affair that Scott was having ahead of time.
I mean, yeah, you don't want to hear just about that on the news, I guess.
Yeah. So as the police tell Lacey's parents that Scott was seeing another woman, they place down the photo in front of her that shows Amber and Scott together at that Christmas party. And Lacey's mom immediately breaks down in tears and says, quote, why did he have to kill her? End quote. And remember, up until this point, they were 100% pro-Scott.
Yeah, but, I mean, her saying that obviously doesn't prove anything, because it's not like she would know a thing.
It's not like it proves anything. It's just, like, crazy that that's where her mind went instantly.
Well, I mean, when you're grieving, all you can do is, you're looking for someone to blame. Like, you're looking to blame someone, and it's, as soon as you have good information, it could be, you know, to feel negative towards someone. It's easiest to blame Scott for her being gone, because obviously by this point, unless she has just straight up run away on her own merit, but like, how could she without her wallet, without her car, she is probably dead.
Right. Yeah. That's just like so chilling that her mom said that.
Yeah, under 100%.
And another thing that Lacey's mom says later in an interview is that the last time she saw Lacey was like, oh, mom, like, I can feel the baby kicking. So naturally, her mom puts her hand on Lacey's pregnant belly and feels the baby kicking. And Lacey turns to her mom and says, quote, mom, Scott doesn't like to do this. I've asked him to feel my stomach when the baby kicks, and he never wants to touch my stomach, end quote.
Which is like, again, that seems kind of odd, just because, like, you'd think you'd be excited to be a parent.
And that's his baby, bro.
Yeah. Even no matter how you're feeling towards your wife, even if you're feeling estranged, you think you'd still care about your child.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that baby's innocent.
That baby's innocent. Well, the other thing is, like, he's been with Lacey for so long. He had to have loved her at some point, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
So, like, he has to have a child
and get married and move and technically give up his dream, you know? Even if he blames her for things like that, you know, if there's, you know.
It's just weird to me that he wouldn't do that. You know, Lacey's mom said that that always really just rubbed her the wrong way after that. And that was the last time she saw Lacey. So after this affair goes public, everyone absolutely fucking hates Scott.
Yeah.
Like, everyone hates him.
Understandably.
So he basically becomes, like, America's most hated man. Everyone is just, like, everyone just suddenly assumes that he's a murderer and calls him a cheater, calls him a scumbag. You know, they start just attacking Scott.
Which, can I say something quick on that? Even though it is really messed up what he did, it's super unhealthy for, I guess unhealthy might not be the right word, but it's
unfair.
Not only unfair, but it's super, I think I want to say unhealthy. Unhealthy for the investigation if all of a sudden everything is going to be blamed on Scott, because if everything starts to be blamed on Scott and Scott
didn't do it, you're never going to find who did it, mm-hmm. because all of efforts are going to start heading towards Scott. And I get right. that a lot of things are pointing to him, but with no other, like, real evidence, mm-hmm. like, with a lot of circumstantial evidence, it doesn't feel like there's enough to even try Scott for it.
Right. And another thing is, like, obviously it's so fucked that he cheated on her.
Yeah, it's incredibly
fucked. And it's awful. But just because someone is a cheater doesn't mean that they're a murderer.
No.
And I'm not saying that I don't think Scott's a murderer, because I definitely think that Scott's a murderer. But I'm just saying it definitely fucks with the investigation when people find out that he's a cheater and people automatically think, like, well, now they think, oh, he's a bad guy. So then that just shifts their entire thought on this whole thing, even though that could have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, 100%.
But it does give the police a motive for why he may have killed her.
It does, a real motive. But just obviously with it being such a public case, to shift such public perception, it can't be good. Because that, I don't know how this story ends, but it feels like then it will get pushed to try Scott. It'll get pushed to investigate only Scott, where there could be other leads that are probably just left in the dust at this point because of how much the public wants it to be Scott.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that's kind of interesting is that there are no other leads. The only lead that they had for a little bit was that a neighbor across the street from Lacey and Scott's house, they were out of town for a couple days, and on the 24th their house got broken into. And some of the things were stolen. And so the police at first thought that it could be possibly related. Like, maybe Lacey saw these people breaking in. And these people were like, oh, fuck, now there's a witness to this. So we have to kidnap her. We have to kill her.
Yeah, that's a very good motive.
Right. So people were like, oh, so it's probably related to this. But the police ended up finding the people who broke into the home and everything. And they were completely cleared as suspects. So there really were no other leads at this point besides Scott.
So I understand then, too, like, pushing for looking at Scott if you have nothing else, but it seems like a very tough case to crack in the end, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So the day after this goes public, Amber gets a call from Scott, and he basically tells her that he wants to tell her how brave she is for doing the press conference. And he's like, that just shows how great of character you have. And she's like, you know, it wasn't really a matter of choice. Like, she's like, the media found me. They've been outside my work all day. Like, I didn't really have a choice. Like, don't be sitting here calling me brave and saying I have good character. Like, I don't, you know, she didn't really want to hear that.
It sounds like he's still trying to suck up. Like, he's trying to not lose her somehow.
Their phone calls were recorded until February 19th of 2003 when Amber tells Scott that they should no longer be in contact due to the circumstances. And believe it or not, Scott agrees. So I listened to this clip. I'm not going to play it just because it's not, I mean, it's really able to be summed up. And just this is that Amber goes, hey, we need to talk. And I don't think we should be talking anymore because of the circumstances and just until this gets resolved. And Scott goes, I agree. And she's like, oh, well, that was easy. And he's like, yeah, I mean, it's the right thing to do. And then that's just it. He just completely agrees. And essentially, that's kind of like their breakup. In 2004, when the trial begins, all of the phone call audio from Scott and Amber is played for the jury. And a few months after their breakup, on April 13th of 2003, the body of Connor Peterson, Lacey and Scott's unborn child, was found on the shore of the San Francisco Bay, about 1 mile northeast of where Scott had been fishing on December 24th, 2002.
See, ever since the story started, I had a weird feeling that he maybe dumped the body when he went quote-unquote fishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what everyone thought.
Yeah.
That's why when people found out he was at the marina that day, they all were like, oh, it was him. Because they're like, he probably dumped the body. And the next day, the body of Lacey Peterson was discovered on the shore about 2 miles northeast of where Scott had been fishing on December 24th. So they were both found within 2 miles of where he had said he was fishing.
Which is very suspicious.
Yeah, yeah. On April 18th, without a cause of death, without a murder weapon, and without a confession, Scott Peterson was arrested and charged with the capital murders of his wife and his child. So when they went to arrest him, Scott claimed that he was meeting his brother and his father for a game of golf. And he actually was nearby a golf course when he was arrested. And this is so strange. His hair, which was naturally dark brown, had been dyed blonde. And his car was, like, overstuffed with a bunch of items, which included $15,000 in cash, 12 Viagra tablets, survival gear, 4 cell phones, camping equipment, several changes of clothes, and 2 driver's license. One of them was his and one of them was his brother's.
This man was running.
Yeah. So Scott's dad, Lee Peterson, later claimed that the reason Scott had his brother's ID was because the day before he had used it to get, like, a San Diego resident discount at this golf course he was going to. But, like, that seems like a lot. Like, that's obviously not true, first of all. But second of all, why? That's not even believable. Like, you're gonna go to your brother and be like, can I borrow your ID to get this discount on this golf course? Like, he was rich.
I was gonna say, he was doing well enough not to have to. I mean, I understand being cheap, but that's, like, so minimal.
Mm-hmm. And especially to, like, pretend to be someone else just to get it. I don't know, it just seems really weird. And then his dad also said that the reason for all the stuff being in Scott's car was that he was living out of his car in attempts to, like, avoid the media attention. So that was, like, Scott's dad being like, no, it's, like, this and that, you know.
But obviously his dad was just trying to protect him.
Yeah, and obviously the police and the prosecutors saw all of this as, like, an indication that he was likely planning to flee the area or even maybe the country. So now I'm going to tell you the police's theory as to what really happened between Scott and Lacey when she went missing. So they believe that Scott killed Lacey in their home either on the night of December 23rd or on the morning of the 24th. So remember the computer activity with the gap scarf and the sunflower umbrella? So this leads many people to believe that she was still alive on the morning of the 24th and that therefore, she was killed sometime on the 24th, like a little bit later on. They also think that the Martha Stewart cooking show story that Scott told the police kind of proves that she was still alive, because, like, why would he be watching Martha Stewart?
Yeah, especially if he murdered his wife the night before.
Yeah, and he's like, I'm just watching Martha Stewart in my kitchen. Like, it just seems unlikely, kind of. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's no reason for him to, like, go that far to make up a thing about Martha Stewart. Specifically watch an episode that was playing, specifically say what time it was playing and what they were talking about. Like, that just seems a little bit, like, too much work. Some people do, of course, believe that he staged this, like, evidence, but most likely she was killed on the 24th. So back to the theory, though, of the police. Since there was no evidence on the cause of death, the police theorized that Scott had probably suffocated Lacey, and they think that Scott put the leash on their dog Mackenzie and let him loose in the neighborhood so that it would look like Lacey had gotten abducted on the walk.
That's some non-care for your dog, Jesus.
Yeah, your dog just gonna get hit by a fucking car, bro.
Yeah.
They think that Scott then moved Lacey's body to his warehouse by putting her body in the back of his truck. So at the warehouse, they believe that Scott attached some homemade cement anchors to her body and placed it in the back of his 14-foot Sears Roebuck boat, which he then brought to the Berkeley Marina. Once he arrived at the marina, he launched his boat, and once he reached the bay, they believe that he pushed the body and the anchors overboard. So they believe that Scott then got back into his truck and made the calls to Lacey's phone in order to cover his tracks. So this theory would also explain the boat launch ticket that Scott used as proof of his alibi. However, it just proves that he was actually at the marina, not that he was really fishing. As far as physical evidence, there was essentially none. No physical or forensic evidence really to support this theory. And even though the police searched the Peterson home for multiple days, they really found nothing that insinuated that a crime had been committed there.
Yeah, but that's probably why they assumed a strangulation, because
right.
if you would just strangle her, there wouldn't be any other physical evidence.
That's exactly what I was just about to say, is that the thing is, like, if Lacey was suffocated or, like, strangled or something, it's not like there would have been blood or a murder weapon laying around.
Also, 90 minutes, as someone who's gone fishing quite a bit, he was only in the, he only did the whole thing, whatever, 78 minutes they believed he was there.
Yeah.
That's not very long to go fishing.
I know. That's a very short time. That's so short. Yeah. I've gone fishing a lot of times too with my family, and like when my dad and my brother and my grandpa go on fishing trips for the day, they're gone all day.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, you'd be out there for hours. Even if it's a waste to just go out there for an hour.
And especially when he was driving an hour and a half, like even like if me and my family are at like our cabin or something and they go out on the lake that's literally right there, they're usually gone for at least 2 hours and they only come back to like get snacks or something, you know, like, and then they go back out. Like, it is really, really weird that he would only be fishing for like that long. And that's not even including the time where he put his boat into the water.
Exactly.
Got it going. Put it back, like took it back out. Like,
another note on this as we're talking about it is, it seemed odd to me too that he had trouble backing in his boat, unless he was flustered, because this man's first date was deep sea fishing.
Yeah, why would he have been having trouble backing his boat?
You think if he owned a truck and owned the boat, he would have? And I'm not saying you can't mess up backing up your thing, even if you have much experience. It just seems. It seemed odd even when you mentioned it, because I was like, man, this guy has to have a lot of experience backing in his boat.
Yeah. Just to mention, though, quick, it was when he was taking his boat out of the water, not when he was putting it in, apparently.
Oh, okay.
So that does kind of change it a little bit, but I agree, it is kind of weird. It's also just kind of funny that he was, like, struggling.
Yeah.
And, like, just specifically that's why the guy could remember him, like, being there, is because he was probably watching him being like, damn, this guy's stupid. Anyways, back to, like, the lack of forensic evidence that they had.
Sorry.
Remember that mop bucket that they took in for, testing and everything?
Yeah, of course.
That came back all negative. No blood, no tissue. Nothing that supported the state's theory that Scott had used it to possibly clean up a crime scene. So, basically, it's possible that Lacey really was using it to mop, or that he just literally put a mop inside of an empty bucket and put it outside to, like, add to the...
Story or
something. And the police say that they did collect some pillowcases at the scene, but they never ended up testing any of them for whatever fucking reason. So therefore they have no evidence that proves like smothering, strangulation, asphyxiation, anything like that. Even though it's possible that like he could have smothered her with a pillow. They didn't end up testing them. I don't know why, but they didn't. So no evidence there either. And also, when they searched Scott's truck for evidence that a dead body was there, they came up with nothing. There were no bodily fluids, none of Lacey's hair was in the truck. The only trace of Lacey was that one hair in that rusted pair of pliers in his warehouse. And it seems like if you put he could have, like, wrapped it up, but there were some tarps in the back of his truck, too, and those also had no traces of any bodily fluids or anything.
I mean, yeah, but he could have dumped the tarps or whatever he did use.
True. You know, he could have, like, washed those.
Yeah. But it doesn't seem like he would use pliers for any reason in it,
no,
you know?
No, it seems like, yeah, I don't think that that's necessarily related. I mentioned earlier that part of the police's theory was that they thought he used homemade cement anchors to weigh her body down.
Yeah.
They did find concrete dust on Scott's trailer. And there was one homemade cement anchor found inside of his boat. So the prosecution believes that there were additional concrete anchors originally, as they found circular spaces on the trailer bed in the midst of all the concrete rubble, as if like anchors had been placed there and then removed. So they think that Scott made 5 anchors and then only used 4 of them to weigh down her body. They searched the bay, but they never found any of the anchors.
I mean, yeah, but they're still just concrete anchors. You'd have to find, if it broke off from the anchors, you would have to find the exact point he dropped it. So I can see that being pretty, even if that is 100% true, it would be hard to find the anchors, I believe.
Yeah. Part of the defense's argument was that there was no way that Scott could have pushed Lacey's body overboard without his boat capsizing. And they actually did multiple demonstrations where they used the exact same model and boat as Scott had. They went to the exact same spot that Scott says he was in. They used a mannequin that they weighed down to be the exact same weight as Lacey. And they had the person who threw the mannequin overboard weighed down so that they weighed exactly the same weight as Scott. And every single time they did it, the boat capsized.
Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is pretty weird. But in the end, the defense wasn't allowed to use this evidence in court for whatever reason. So the jury didn't even end up seeing this evidence.
Which is not good for Scott.
No, not at all. On April 21st of 2003, Scott was called before the court in Modesto, where this all took place, before Judge Nancy Ashley. He was charged with two felony counts of murder with premeditation and special circumstances, and of course he pled not guilty. However, another judge of that county moved his trial to San Mateo County because so many people in Modesto had already made up their mind about Scott, based on like the media attention and the gossip and all that, that they thought it would be more fair if they moved it at least a little bit further, but that didn't do much anyway because pretty much everyone knew about this case, especially in California.
Yeah, but it was thoughtful at least to move it because I agree it needed to be.
100%. So his trial began on June 1st of 2004, and Scott never once took to the stand to speak regarding the case. And individuals who were present in the jury that day say that the majority of the people who were at the trial were in tears throughout the trial. And the only one who never cried was Scott.
But again, that's just, that can't be used as evidence. That's no, just, you know.
I just think it's interesting. But well, also, like, I can see that, like, he could be spooked as hell. Like,
I was gonna say,
I'm about to go to prison, like, yeah.
By that point, yeah, you're already going, they think I did it.
Mm-hmm.
My life is
but
over.
But honestly, I think even if I didn't do it and I was there, I'd be crying because I'd be so scared and sad that they thought I did it, you know? Mm-hmm.
Or at least scared and sad that I'm going to prison.
Yeah.
Did it or not.
Yeah, like, it's just weird in general that he wasn't crying. It just makes him seem kind of, like, strange and, like, emotionless.
But it seems like he's been kind of emotionless throughout this whole thing.
For sure. So, on November 12th, 2004, Scott Peterson was convicted of first-degree murder for his wife's death and second-degree murder for his unborn son, Connor. The judge sentenced Scott to death, calling the murder of Lacey, quote, cruel, uncaring, heartless, and callous, end quote.
He got the death penalty?
Yeah. Actually, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection, specifically. However, this past March of 2019, the California governor issued a moratorium for all 737 of the prisoners on death row in California, which included Scott, obviously. And this meant that the death penalty will be postponed and not in use for the rest of the time that he's in tenure as a governor. And he will remain governor until at least 2022, and then he'll be up for re-election. And if he does get re-elected, he'll be in office until January of 2027. So that is, like, a very long time that Scott still will not be executed.
Yeah.
And today, Scott Peterson still remains behind bars in the San Quentin prison in California. And, of course, hundreds of people still believe in Scott's innocence to this day and claim that he's been wrongfully convicted. There are tons and tons of pages online of just groups of people who believe that Scott's innocent coming together, trying to get him to have a new trial, trying to get his sentence appealed, and just so many people who think that he was wrongfully convicted just because of the lack of evidence in this case.
I was going to say, it's pretty crazy. I can see him getting convicted, but it's insane to me that he got the death penalty with such a lack of evidence.
Right. There was, honestly, zero, absolutely zero physical evidence in this case. It was all circumstantial evidence.
Well, other than the bodies being found pretty close to where he was.
Right, but that's still, like, somewhat circumstantial.
It is somewhat circumstantial, but not finding him buried or in the woods or anything, finding him in the water
where he said he was
is pretty.
And it's not even like we found out that you were there. It's like you admitted you were there. Like,
and it's not like that was public knowledge where whoever did it could set him up and be like,
right,
hey, drive out to this exact kind of point and dump him,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's the story about Lacey Peterson and Scott Peterson. I personally do believe that Scott was responsible for the murder of Lacey and Connor. I just don't really see who else. Like, there just seems like there's no other reasonable answer for it.
Well, yeah,
opinion.
a lot of different things point to him.
Right.
He had motive. The bodies being found in that area, there not really being any other good leads or possibilities. It just, everything really points to him. So it's kind of crazy if he didn't do it that everything
would be
pointing
to him.
Yeah,
he has very bad luck if he didn't do it.
I wonder how different he would have been sitting if the affair didn't happen.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it's hard to say. You know, I was about to say I think that he would still have been convicted, but I honestly don't know.
Yeah, because that shifted public
because
opinion,
that,
I'm sure,
yeah, that
so
completely
much.
Changed everything.
And if he would have been more active in the initial investigation, too, it wouldn't have, because that's a big ding off of him initially, is that he didn't want to be part of the investigation. But he didn't want to be in part of the investigation because of the affair. So
yeah, so that fucked with literally
everything.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there, too, the affair might have been the reason it happened.
There's a lot of interviews online, like a lot of video clips of different people interviewing Scott during the time that he was, like, not yet in prison. And I think that, like, they're very interesting. Watching the way that he acts and the way that he talks, the way that he speaks about Lacey. There's even a lot of clips of, like, him from the news stories that came out, like, right after she went missing. Just everything he says is so emotionless. Like, anyone who's listening to this, I encourage you to go look up videos of him, like, interviews of him online, because it'll just give you so much of a better picture of who he is and, like, how he acts, especially in front of, like, the media. It's just very interesting to see how he acts. And I think it adds a lot to how I perceive his actions and his statements in this case as well. That wraps up today's episode on the case of Lacey Peterson. I hope that all of you tune in next time to hear about another case. And as always, make sure to follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at Crime Chamber Podcast and on Twitter at Crime Chamber. Make sure to subscribe or follow us on whatever platform you're currently listening, and feel free to leave a review if you have any comments about the podcast. As always, thanks to Thunder Wolf Media for providing us with our beautiful intro music. Big thanks to my fiance Riggs for being on today's episode and helping me talk about this insane case that took forever to tell you guys about.
It was a pleasure.
I will talk to you guys soon.